Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, January 20th, 2026, we are delighted to host this discussion on the new proposed Waters of the United States rule. My name is Matthew Sautel, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. In the interest of time, we'll keep the introductions brief, but if you would like to know more about any of our panelists, you can access their full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we're honored to be joined by Professor Pat Parenteau, Professor of Law Emeritus at Vermont Law School, Mr. John Paul Woodley, who is Principal at Advantis Strategies LLC, and Mr. Damian Schiff, who is Senior Attorney at Pacific Legal Foundation. And our webinar will be moderated by Mr. Darren Baxt, who is Director of the Center for Energy and Environment and a Senior Fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. One last note throughout the panel, if you have any questions, please submit them through the question and answer feature in Zoom so that we'll have access to them when we get to that portion of the webinar. We do ask that questions submitted there both pertain to this discussion and end with a question mark. With that, thank you for being with us today. Darren, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Matthew. I really appreciate it. And I want to thank all of you today for watching today's webinar and either live or I guess later on. As Matthew said, I'm Darren Baxt. I'm the director of the Center for Energy and Environment at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI. And today we're going to discuss one of the most important ongoing environmental law issues. What waters are regulated under the Clean Water Act? It seems like a simple question, but it hasn't proven to be simple. The agency is responsible for defining WOTUS, the waters of the United States. The EPA and the Army Corps have failed repeatedly to create a definition that can withstand judicial scrutiny. So the Clean Water Act allows for the regulation of navigable waters, which is then defined as waters of the United States, including the territorial seas. Much of the focus is really on what does waters of the United States mean. From 2001 to 2023, the United States Supreme Court struck down EPA and Corps efforts to regulate WOTUS three different times. And this is connected to the agency's going beyond what the court thought was authorized by law. But the good news is in 2023, the Supreme Court in Sackett versus EPA finally provided some clarity as to what is meant by WOTUS. Now, recently, the EPA and Corps proposed a new WOTUS rule that is supposed to be consistent with Sackett. The comment period ended a couple weeks ago on January 5th, and a final rule is likely to be coming out soon. So what's in this proposed rule? How does it define key terms from the Sackett case? Is it consistent with Sackett? So we're going to discuss these questions and a lot more. So here's the game plan for today's program. We're going to start with some brief remarks from our expert panel, but today's webinar is also going to be a discussion. And please make sure you do ask questions, and I'll integrate those questions into the discussion that we have today. So John Paul Woodley, JP, will tell us what's in the rule. Damian and Professor Pat Parenteau will then provide analysis of the rule. Then we'll have our discussion. So let's get started, and JP, I'm going to turn it over to you to tell us what's in the proposed WOTUS rule.
Well, thank you, Darren, and thanks to everyone for tuning in today. It's a real privilege to be part of this very distinguished panel, and we're here to talk about one of what has to be one of my favorite topics, the definition of waters of the United States under the Clean Water Act. In fact, I actually visited Pass Law School up in Vermont about 15 years ago under the auspices of the Federalist Society chapter there to discuss with them the most recent Supreme Court at the time, the most recent Supreme Court statement on the issue, which was the Rapanos decision. And matters have only gotten more complicated and interesting since that day. I'm going to talk briefly about what the agencies say that they are intending to do and how they describe the provisions that they have proposed in this notice of proposed rulemaking. Their intent, their stated intent, and then we'll talk about whether they have succeeded in this regard. Their stated intent is to adhere faithfully to the Supreme Court direction, respect the Clean Water Act's careful balance between federal authority and state responsibility over waters, and carry out Congress's overall objectives to restore and maintain the integrity of the nation's waters in a manner that preserves the traditional sovereignty of the states over their own land and water resources, pursuant to the cooperative federalism framework predicated by the Clean Water Act. Now, in aid of those objectives, they have made several, or proposing to make several, major changes to the Clean Water Act regulations. First, they want to define relatively permanent as a term to ensure that the Sackett decision, the most recent Supreme Court decision on the Clean Water Act, argued, by the way, by our fellow panelist Damien, before the Supreme Court, that decision is fully implemented. And that term focuses on those waters that are standing or continuously flowing year-round, or at least during the wet season, quote-unquote wet season. This would be applicable to the tributaries and lakes and ponds category. They wanted to define the term tributary to ensure that only those relatively permanent bodies of water that meet specific requirements are included and considered jurisdictional. They want to define the term continuous surface connection to fully implement the Sackett decision, meaning that the term would require the wetland to meet two conditions and in a two-part test to be jurisdictional. First, they must abut or actually touch a jurisdictional water, and two, they must have surface water at least during, once again, the term wet season. They want to remove interstate waters from the category of jurisdictional waters so that it makes clear that waters are not jurisdictional merely because they cross a state line. They want to clarify what constitutes excluded ditches through a proposed definition of a ditch that distinguishes these features from other types of waters and excludes those ditches that are constructed or excavated entirely in dry land. They want to make several changes concern the prior converted cropland rule, with a definition that allows the agencies to identify prior converted cropland and ensure that prior converted cropland only loses its designation and prior converted cropland is excluded from the coverage of the Clean Water Act, and it only loses this designation when it has been abandoned and reverts to a wetland. They want to clarify what constitutes an excluded wastewater treatment system through the addition of a definition that provides helpful direction as to the breadth of the systems that meet the exclusion. And finally, they want to make it perfectly clear, then underscore that groundwater is not considered water of the United States, and they're doing that through a specific exclusion. So those are the outline of how the agencies describe what they intended to accomplish and the major changes that they have proposed to the rule in this rulemaking process.
Thanks so much, JP. That's great. Great summary. So, Damien, I'm going to turn to you. What's your take on this rule?
Thanks, Darren. And I also appreciate the opportunity here for the Federal Society to talk about the proposed WOTUS rule. Picking up on what JP was discussing with respect to the proposed rule, I think that from my perspective, having been involved in these WOTUS issues for some time, perhaps the most significant aspect of the proposed rule is how it deals with wetlands regulation. And JP noted that the proposal offers a two-part test. One is that the wetland has to physically abut another regulated water. Secondly, that there has to be the continuous presence of surface water connecting that wetland to the abutting water, at least during the wet season. That proposal is, I think, more or less faithful to the Sackett decision, but it's, in my view, a significant improvement from how the Biden administration had been interpreting and applying Sackett, both with respect to EPA and the Corps' administrative interpretation, as well as with respect to how the Department of Justice employed Sackett in its litigation immediately after the decision came down. The Biden administration took the view that when the Sackett majority opinion says that wetlands to be regulated can only be regulated if they have a, quote, continuous surface connection with another regulated water, took the view that continuous surface connection didn't need to be aquatic. It wasn't really quite clear what it could be other than aquatic, but definitely the administration resisted the idea that you had to have, really for any period of time, the continuous presence of surface water. And so, as you can imagine, that was an attempt to pretty seriously, I think, narrow the effect or limit the effect of Sackett with respect to what wetlands can be regulated under the Clean Water Act. So this proposal by the Trump administration to require a surface water connection, specifically water, that is, I think, not only consistent with Sackett, but that is a change from how the prior administration operated. More generally, the proposal's emphasis upon indistinguishability for regulating wetlands is, I think, significant. In the Sackett opinion itself, the majority opinion written by Justice Alito, he uses the word indistinguishable or variations of that word repeatedly. And the idea, I think, was that statute can only regulate wetlands to the extent that they're effectively like their adjoining waters, that you can't meaningfully distinguish the two. And the reason for that, in the opinion itself, was that, as you noted, Darren, at the top of the hour, that the Clean Water Act itself, in its definitional section, doesn't mention wetlands. It just says waters. And so that was a key textual clue for the Supreme Court's conclusion in Sackett that really wetlands can only be incidentally regulated to the extent that they're basically indistinguishable, quote unquote, from adjoining waters. And so the proposed rule's preamble and its emphasis on indistinguishability, that also, I think, is not only consistent with Sackett, but also is a change from the Biden administration, and I think a change in the right direction. Another thing in the preamble itself that I think is important to note is the agency's commitment to whatever rule they come up with respect to wetlands regulation, that they're only going to regulate that portion of a wetland that otherwise satisfies the test that they're going to adopt, meaning that simply because a wetland might be delineated as being, say, 5 acres in size, doesn't mean that now the entire 5 acres can be regulated just because a portion of it might be indistinguishable from an adjoining water. The agency's made clear in the preamble that they're only going to regulate the portion of the wetland that otherwise qualifies. That is also a pretty big change, not just from the Biden administration, but from other earlier administrations that took a pretty broad view of once a wetland qualifies as regulable, how much of the wetland can we regulate? Generally, the agencies have said the whole thing. That's a pretty big deal in places like Alaska, where arguably the wetland extends for miles and miles and miles out from the regulated water. Then quickly, two criticisms, shall we say, from my perspective, in litigating these cases and how the agencies have made their proposal. One is this phrase we've already mentioned a few times, and I'm sure we're going to talk a lot more in the hour about wet season. That's a big concept in the rule, that whether it's a tributary or whether it's a wetland, there has to be water present continuously during the, quote, wet season. That's a big deal because wet season is not a concept that's found in the Sackett opinion. It's not a concept found in the Rapanos opinion. It's not a concept found in any prior rulemaking. And so it seems to be introducing into an area of the law where we want certainty, finally, perhaps a new source of uncertainty. That seems problematic. And then finally, the preamble's discussion about the extent to which culverts or other sort of man-made features can maintain jurisdiction, that as long as water is flowing through a culvert, that might still allow the agencies to regulate a wetland or regulate a tributary, because there would still be the continuous flow of water during the wet season. That also, I think, is a little problematic. It's certainly in the last several decades of WOTUS litigation, connections like culverts and other manufactured connections have been the source of a lot of regulatory uncertainty. So the fact that the agencies are suggesting that they might still use these artificial connections to justify their authority, that is a little concerning. But I would say, Darren, in summary, my view of the proposal is pretty darn good, not perfect, but we shouldn't let the good become the enemy of the perfect. And I think the agencies are definitely moving towards a greater consistency, in my view, with how Sackett should be interpreted.
Thank you, Damien. Appreciate it. Professor Parenteau, what's your take?
Thanks a lot. So I have to start with a tip of the hat to Damien. Much as I hate the outcome at Sackett, I have to admire the ability that Damien showed in winning the case. He did have some a wind at his back, so to speak, with this court, but still he delivered. So good on you, I would say, Damien, on that regard. So my take on the rule is it's awful, it's terrible, it's bad public policy, it's certainly bad for water quality. But I think we're here to discuss mostly the law. So what I would say is it misreads Sackett. It misreads the Clean Water Act text, purpose, and history. It misreads prior decisions of the U.S. Supreme Court, particularly Riverside Bayview. It certainly misreads the science. In fact, it has no science whatsoever behind it. So you start with relatively permanent, undefined, and a problematic term to be sure. What I would suggest, being here in the desert Southwest right now, which is in the midst of a multi-year mega drought, that's what the climate scientists and the hydrologists out here are calling it. You have to take account of not only geographic differences in the country when you talk about relatively permanent. You have to take account of things like, obviously, topography and hydrology. But more and more, as much as the Trump administration may wish to deny it, you have to take account of climate change. You have to look at what climate change is doing to precipitation patterns, flow patterns around the country. And this rule, of course, makes no mention of that whatsoever, not even a nod. You wouldn't expect that, would you? But in the litigation to come, both facial challenges and as applied challenges, which I'm sure we'll talk about somewhat today, I think that's going to be a central feature of attacking the way that this rule approaches relatively permanent. When you come to continuous surface connection, I got to agree with Damon. You can't deny that the Sackett decision, again, I don't agree with it at all, but you can't deny that that is the test, right? But what does it mean? And you know, maybe the Biden administration went too far, but I would suggest that this rule either goes too far or doesn't go far enough. And what I mean is, if you look at Justice Kavanaugh's concurrence, joined by the three sort of liberal members of the court, forming a four-justice agreement, you see the problem with not accounting for what has happened to the waters of the U.S. And by that, I mean, when you think about all the channelization that occurred, particularly in the whole eastern half of the United States, funded by the federal government, stimulated by with the old Soil Conservation Service, there's estimates of 60% of the streams and tributaries in the eastern United States have been altered by channelization. And so, you know, you don't really have a lot of purely natural streams left and tributary systems left. You have obstacles, you have berms, you have dikes, you have rock piles, you have lots of things that interrupt what would otherwise be a natural continuous flow. I'm going to predict that the lower courts are not going to disregard that. And again, facts are going to determine a lot of what happens in the future. This rule doesn't clarify anything. It doesn't settle anything. I mean, I've been doing this stuff for 55 years, so I got you beat, Damien, on that. I've done it as a a public interest lawyer, a private lawyer, a government lawyer, a U.S. EPA lawyer. I administered our own program in Vermont. So I really have seen this program from many different perspectives for a very long period of time. And I can tell you, this ain't over. It's just not over. When you come to wet season, I mean, where does that come from? My God, it has no scientific credibility whatsoever. I was asking several people at a recent seminar here that are hydrologists and geomorphologists, what does that mean to you? And they said, well, what do you mean? What parameters are you using? That's not going to survive. I wouldn't even be surprised if it doesn't get struck down as a facial challenge. We'll see. Then there's this business about what's the difference between ephemeral and intermittent. You have to say Sackett pretty much puts a knife in the ephemeral streams. But not the intermittent, I would argue. If you look at Scalia's footnote, I think it was 5 or 7, maybe footnote 7, Damien would know, in Rapanos. Even he acknowledged that, this business about intermittency is complicated. And maybe sort of seasonal rivers or seasonal tributaries would be in, even if they're not navigable. That just leaves a lot of questions about intermittent streams. I think is going to be a bone of contention for sure. Can't argue about abutting. I can't argue about that. I mean, Alito was clear about that. He rejected, the text of the statute on adjacency and said, no, I'm going to use the word abutting. That statute doesn't use it. I do. So you definitely have that. Interstate waters are out. Really? I mean, if you think about the Rivers and Harbors Act of 1899, that law regulated non-navigable tributaries. It regulated the entire tributary system of the United States. And the Fourth Circuit, with Justice Luttig, and said that forget the case now, but they said that in a very, very strong opinion. No Commerce Clause problem whatsoever with that. So I think that one's vulnerable. And I'm also looking at the time and thinking maybe it's time for me to stop.
That's great. And it's footnote 5, by the way.
There you go.
that's great. So I just want to remind everybody, because we're going to start the discussion now, to ask questions. In the middle of your screen, you'll see the little Q&A box down there. Just ask your questions. So let me ask the first question. And I want to ask about the interplay between relatively permanent and wet season. So the Supreme Court, we've talked about this, they made it clear that the waters that we're talking about are relatively permanent waters. And the court has used language throughout the opinions, Rapanos, Sackett, whatever, that regulable waters are like fixed bodies of water, the ordinary presence of water. The proposed rule, though, would cover waters that have surface water for as little as 4 months of the year due to this wet season concept. So my question is, how can this be considered a relatively permanent water? And Damien, let me start with you.
I also am share some of Professor Parenteau's concern about wet season. It's a concept that's kind of hard to nail down. I believe that where it's coming from is, again, this, we talk about footnote 4 from Caroline Prize, now there's footnote 5 from Rapanos. This reference in Justice Scalia's plurality opinion in Rapanos, where he says that relatively permanent doesn't mean that we're going to exclude waters that flow for less than 365 days a year. And he talks about, quote unquote, seasonal rivers. And then he says, more generally, we don't necessarily exclude from regulation waters that may not flow during, quote, dry months. And I think that term, dry months, was then inverted in the proposed rule as, well, that means wet season. Now, I suspect that that's probably not what Justice Scalia had in mind. And I think as a matter of science, obviously I'm not a scientist, but I suspect that the concept of wet season is not really the inversion of dry months. But in any event, I think that's where it's coming from. I think the relatively permanent waters issue is, I also agree with Professor Parenteau about this. I think that's a hard one because it's a concept that comes from Justice Scalia. He got it from a dictionary, and there's not much provenance there. I will say this, that whatever you say about wet season with respect to tributaries or other types of waters, I find it particularly hard to understand how that concept plays into wetlands regulation. Because on that, the Sackett majority opinion says the test is continuous surface connection. Now, continuous, you know, typically, I think, is understood to mean without any interruption. And in fact, the Alito majority opinion gives two exceptions to that test. One is low tides and the other is drought. Now, given those exceptions, I don't quite understand how you can say, well, there's also an exception for when you don't have surface water present for less than the entire year, but at least you've got it present for the, quote, wet season. So I think wet season is problematic. I think it comes from this inversion of footnote 5 in the Rapanos plurality opinion. I think it might be justifiable for tributaries. I find it hard to understand how it applies to wetlands.
Just, I can't help myself, but in that footnote 5, it doesn't just say dry months. It says, and then the next thing is such as a 290-day continuously flowing stream. That's the example provided, and nor do the plurality say that that had to be covered. It just, it might be. They're not necessarily excluding that. So I just want to clarify that point. So JP, let me turn it to you.
Yeah, well, that's, I agree that the wet season is never invoked by the Supreme Court, but a period of drought, of dry season is. And as I think David's exactly right, they said, well, if we need to look at what happens to a stream during the dry season, we can't necessarily exclude a stream that it doesn't flow all year long. So when does it flow? Well, they're saying, well, it would flow during, I guess, during the wet season. The problem I have with the wet season concept is how easily administered it would be. And the problem is simply that there is no such thing as an average year. You know, you go if you're trying to determine your wet season and how a particular piece of landscape behaves in terms of its whether surface water exists on it or whether it's flowing during something you've defined as a wet season. Well, those are my understanding is that those are defined by averages that have taken are based on observations over many, many years. And you say, well, this is for this location, on average, there's a wet season from this day to this day in any given year. The problem with that, of course, is that there's no such thing as that average year doesn't exist. It doesn't happen. It's either every year is either wetter than that average year or drier than that average year. Which means that in order to determine your jurisdiction, you would have to observe. You would either have to have a tool that would answer this question, or I don't know that one exists. I wish someone would tell me that one existed. Or you have to conduct an in-depth monitoring and observation of the particular piece of real estate over a period of years. Well, that's simply not workable. People need it. If I'm applying for or deciding whether or not to apply for and the kind a permit and deciding what the parameters of that permit must be, I need to know now what the federal jurisdiction is and what kind of permit I need to apply for and what kind of mitigation I need to plan for and what kind of avoidance I need to do. And if I can't, if the Corps is going to come and tell me, well, sir, on your property, we need to look for standing water during the wet season, and this season has been been very dry. So we can't say that that our jurisdiction only extends as far as the water is standing in this year. So we'll have to come back next year and take a look. And I assure you that no permittee in any state of the country is going to put up with that. And so if they can tell me and they seem to be they're putting a lot of reliance on remote sensing, aerial photography, other kind of desktop tools, software that can answer these questions. But no, there is no substitute for on the ground observation when you're dealing with federal jurisdiction. Because there's several things you must remember in this context. The first is that the Clean Water Act carries criminal implications. Violation carries criminal liability, and so a landowner must know and must be able to determine at any point in time, on any day of the week, exactly where the federal Clean Water Act jurisdiction exists and where it does not exist on his property. Otherwise, he will be committing a federal crime or not committing a federal crime, depending on how wet whether it's been raining lately. And that's simply not acceptable. There are 1,300 core employees in the regulatory program nationwide in 38 districts. They need to know every day where their jurisdiction is and how far their power extends. I'm reminded of Benjamin R. Curtis back in 1864. Very interesting gentleman, one of the dissenters in the Dred Scott case, by the way. But I have a quote from him that let it be remembered also, for just now we may be in some danger of forgetting it. The questions of jurisdiction are questions of power, as between the United States and the several states. So this is not an academic, you know, it's really an academic discussion. This is a question that implicates criminal liability for citizens. It implicates the ability of individuals to develop their property in appropriate ways. And it implicates the distribution of power between the United States and the several states. And so I think that they got a lot of work to do in order to make this wet season concept administrable. And I apologize for going on so long. I could go on much longer.
Thanks, JP. Pat, what's your take about this? What I'd argue about the relatively permanent definition in the proposed rule?
Well, the wet season, I think, have we successfully killed and buried it? I don't know. It seems to me like we have. I'll add a couple of things to what JP was saying, and that is, don't forget citizen suits. Landowners may be told by the Corps, either through a preliminary JD or something else, not to worry, you don't need a permit. That doesn't stop anything. That opens the door to litigation. And I can guarantee you the environmental public interest community is locked and loaded on this. And they are well staffed these days. And there will be lots and lots of litigation. And I think that's unfair to landowners. I don't see any, the fair notice doctrine cuts both ways. It's both you do need a permit or you don't need a permit. So I don't see any fair notice in this at all. So, I've represented entities accused of violating the Clean Water Act and did the best I could to get them out of it. But the point is, if you're trying to clarify, and as the rule preambles talks about, the average American can walk out and determine what is jurisdictional. Really? That's just a disservice. And I think I'll better stop.
Thanks. Pat, actually, let me turn you to another question real quick. I think you'd probably agree that the proposed rule is going to mean fewer federally protected waters and wetlands. I don't know if you have any numbers on this. And is there anything, I mean, the proposed rule has to be consistent with SAC. Is there something that you think the proposed rule did wrong to kind of to limit the scope of what should be covered? Obviously you do. And then I'm going to ask quickly for Damien and JP to just talk about this concern about there's going to be fewer protected waters as a result of this rule. So Pat, why don't you start?
Oh my God. I mean, the regulatory impact analysis itself says 80% of the wetlands of the United States will no longer have federal protection. And that doesn't just mean no federal protection. That means no protection, because over half of the states have laws on the books right now that says that their wetland regulations will be no stricter than federal. And following the Sackett decision, three states, Louisiana, Kentucky, Tennessee, acted to roll back their state laws. Two other states, New Mexico and Colorado, acted to try to fill the gap as best they can. So the impact on the nation's wetlands resources, and I have to say I'm a big fan of wetlands, is indescribable. I mean, these are some of the most biologically important resources in the United States. They not only control floods and filter pollutants and sequester carbon and provide fisheries habitat and on, so on and on and on and on. The idea that you could casually suggest a rule change with that kind of dramatic impact on the natural resources of the country without an environmental impact statement, without consultation under the Endangered Species Act, because many, many listed species depend on wetlands, almost half, is staggering to me. So there are serious procedural errors and vulnerabilities in this rule. I wish I were still young enough to go and litigate these things. I'd have a field day, but I know a lot of the people who will be litigating them, and they're very good litigators, right along with Damien. And so it's sad to say, frankly, I'm not happy about this. I wish that we could find a place where some kind of agreement, consensus could be reached on what the federal government should be regulating and the rest of it that's left to the states. What kind of program would help the states that are willing to address some of these issues do it? Because when I was director of our environmental program in Vermont, last point, a fourth of my staff was funded by EPA. Without EPA funding, we would not have had a regulatory program implementing all of these federal laws, plus the state laws. I don't think Vermont's alone in that. I think most states are going to be very, very hard pressed to step up and fill the gap here. I don't think it'll happen. So I think that's really an extremely unfortunate outcome if that's what in fact happens. I'll stop.
Thanks. Damien, let me turn it to you.
I think if you were to ask the agencies the same question, they'd say, well, actually, we're being somewhat judicious here. We're compromising because our interpretation of Sackett as being key to this wet season concept will actually ensure that there are some wetlands that will still be federally regulated. And whether that's a fair interpretation of Sackett or not, I think the agencies are sensitive to that issue. Now, legally, I would say, well, the effect of on water quality of regulating or not regulating wetlands, that's separate from how we interpret the statute. And in fact, actually, in the Sackett opinions themselves, even in the concurrences, there wasn't really much emphasis on environmental policy. It was really much more of a traditional sort of textual legal debate. That being said, on the policy question, I think it is fair to say that, yes, the Clean Water Act, as interpreted by Sackett, does mean that there aren't that many wetlands that are federally regulated. But that in and of itself shouldn't be too surprising in our federal system when you consider that most wetlands regulation is really a type of land use regulation. And land use is traditionally an issue in our system reserved to state and local governments. Now, how to balance land use regulation with the development of property for residential or commercial or industrial purposes. How do you balance that with the environmental externalities of that sort of development? That also is a classic policy question, a balancing question that is traditionally left to the state and local governments. As Pat mentioned, there are some states that have said after Sackett, we like that. We don't think there should be as much regulation because we in our state want to encourage more development. There are other states like Colorado and New Mexico and California that said, no, we want to continue to regulate, even though the feds decided not to. That policy debate about balancing environmental regulation with productive use of private property, that I think reasonable people can disagree on how that balance should be struck. But I do think in our federal system, that is a balance striking prerogative that is really not appropriate for the feds, for EPA and the Corps to be doing. It really is something that should be done at the state and local level.
Thanks, Damon. JP, real quick.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing that the lesson that I've drawn from the Supreme Court's decisions, as problematic as they have been, is that it boils down to this: that somewhere on the landscape, there is a line, and on one side of that line is federal jurisdiction concurrent with state and local jurisdiction. On the other side of that line is exclusive state and local jurisdiction. And so I really don't know. I can't tell you where the right place or what the right answer is, but I'm absolutely certain what the wrong answer is when you're defining waters of the United States. And that is any answer that where you can look at it and say, I don't see a line here. I don't know where federal jurisdiction ends and exclusive state and local jurisdiction begins. And if you can't do that, then that's the wrong answer. Now, this rule, I'd say, has some things that allow you to say they have definitely defined a line. The difficulty is that it's a line that seems hard to actually draw on the landscape itself. So, I think it definitely needs improvement in that regard, but they have definitely defined a line. And the difficulty with defining the line or seeking to define the line based on ecological values, which is, I think what, the Obama administration and later the Biden administration sought to do is that they end up with rules in which there is no line. And whatever the answer is, whatever the right answer is, that's definitely the wrong answer.
Thanks. And just, I'm going to ask one question that is short answer. To me, the agencies really don't have a lot of flexibility here. They're interpreting the Sackett case, and the Sackett case basically adopting a plurality opinion in Rapanos. And I don't think they have much flexibility. And some of these disputes about the coverage, really, you can blame the court if you want, but can you really blame the agencies? So, Damon, I'll start with you on this one. Just, I feel like it's an interpretation issue here.
Yeah, this is sort of an administrative law aspect of the WOTUS rules that I think after Loper Bright and the abrogation of the Chevron doctrine is particularly important, because in years past, you could understand why the agencies would want to spend so much time producing a WOTUS rule, because they would receive Chevron deference and their reasonable interpretation of the ambiguous waters of the United States would then become the law of the land. After Loper Bright, though, there is no special deference that this rule will receive, at least formally. And so the value of the rule is much reduced. I think, you know, theoretically, one could say that the agencies don't even need to go through notice and comment, because it truly is an interpretative rule, and interpretative rules under the APA are don't have to go through notice and comment. Now, there are aspects of the rule, like prior converted cropland, where one could say, well, that's really substantive and that's appropriate for notice and comment. But as you've pointed out, Darren, ultimately what they're trying to do is they're trying to interpret a Supreme Court opinion. And so even in under the Chevron days, one might have asked, well, would they even get deference on that? Because they're not interpreting statutory text. There's no theory of congressional delegation to agencies to then interpret Supreme Court opinions. So I think it remains to be seen what the value of the rule will be in litigation, other than the fact that, yes, it's a public statement from the agencies that helps to inform the public as to how the agencies will interpret the law. And it's certainly, as JP mentioned, too, with respect to core personnel, EPA personnel on the ground, they'll have a clear idea, one hopes, as well, about how the statute should be interpreted. But beyond that, it's not clear to me what the administrative law benefits, so to speak, are of the rule.
JP, do you have anything you want to add on that?
Oh, yes. Let me say that I am very sympathetic with the plight of the agencies in this context. I went through it myself. I was the Assistant Secretary of the Army for Civil Works when the Rapanos decision came through as a 4-4-1 decision. And the only thing that 8 justices of the Supreme Court could agree on was that Justice Kennedy's significant nexus test was ridiculous and had no basis in law or science or any other fountain of jurisprudence, but that he made it up because he thought it was a good idea, and they all rejected it. So what was the rule that we were implementing after the Rapanos decision? Well, it was the significant nexus test from Justice Kennedy. 8 justices of the Supreme Court said it's hooey, and we were implementing it as federal law, as a basis for federal jurisdiction. So, you know, is this a great country or what? Anyway, so my sympathy is for their plight is quite deep. Because the court can say relatively permanent. Relative to what? It's relatively permanent, not permanent. If the court said permanent, well, fine. We could be much more definite about what we were seeking to regulate. But they didn't say permanent. They said relatively permanent, and they didn't say relative to what. And then they started talking about the dry season and it flowing 290 days or 289 days or 270 days or 10 days. How do you, I've got 1,300 people in the field who need to know where their jurisdiction is. They need to know. And the reason they need to know is if they extend their the reach of their regulatory power beyond that line, beyond that jurisdiction, that's tyranny. And if they extend it, if they recede it and do not extend their regulatory authority up to the limit of it, then that's abdication. And they have to, they need to know where that line is because they need to respect it every day. And they're not the only ones. The landowners, the regulated people, they need to know where it is because it's a criminal violation of the Clean Water Act if you do certain things within that jurisdiction, which is perfect, with things which are perfectly legal 2 feet away from that, from where that jurisdiction ends. So my sympathy for the agencies is quite profound, and I hope they find their way out of this mess, but I don't necessarily think that this rule will get them there.
Thanks, JP. And Pat, real quick, do you have anything on this?
Well, I guess I would say the significant Texas test was not that bad. It came from Justice Rehnquist's statement in Swank. Kennedy basically formulated it on the unanimous opinion in Riverside Bayview. If you go back and look at that case, that's all about ecology and the value of wetlands and all of their functions. Right. So I'm not so quick to say the significant nexus test was a failure. In fact, if you look at the history of the lower court decisions after Rapanos, they all figured it out. There was a uneasy, I would say, truce over jurisdiction. Not everybody agreeing. Don't get me wrong, on both sides. But I don't know that we've improved it. I would say the Supreme Court has been acting outside its lane for a long time on this, monkeying around with things they don't understand, scientifically illiterate, and making things up. And that's a role for Congress. Congress is perfectly capable of making things up. And, you know, the Trump administration could have said, we don't like what Biden did, maybe repeal that rule, maybe issue guidance, maybe take a little time to field test some different approaches. But to create a rule like this and provide a, I think, juicy target for litigation, mark my words, this rule will not survive litigation. End of story.
Thanks, Pat. I want to talk about wetlands a bit more. I think it's pretty clear, and somebody can jump in and disagree if they want, but I think it's pretty clear, I think Damian talked about this, that wetlands by themselves are not WOTUS. There are only regulable wetlands. They're regulable to the extent that they're kind of, you can't tell where the water ends and the wetland begins or land begins. So it's, you know, it's about indistinguishability, et cetera. So that, I think that's a kind of key language about the indistinguishable part of it. So the proposed rule defines, so we're looking at, we need to look at this connection between the water and the wetland. So the proposed rule defines continuous surface connection in this way. Continuous surface water means having surface water at least during the wet season and abutting a jurisdictional water. So again, we get into this the wet season language, and I just want to get your take on this definition. Again, Damon, you touched on it before. Why don't you quickly just state what you think about this definition, including this connection with the wet season language, and I'll go around quickly to the other two.
Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, Darren, during the Biden administration, the EP and the Corps and DOJ took the view that continuous surface connection doesn't mean continuous surface water connection. The current administration's proposal, I think, is consistent with Sackett, because Justice Alito's majority opinion says there are two exceptions to our continuous surface connection test. One is low tides. The second is drought. Now, both of those exceptions are aquatic exceptions, surface water, aquatic related exceptions. So I think it's pretty clear that the Supreme Court meant continuous surface water connection. And that plays into the point that you were just making, Darren, about how kind of what's driving the legal analysis in SAC. And you can disagree with this, obviously, as a legal proposition. But what I think, in fact, is driving the legal analysis is the proposition that the statute regulates, quote, waters. It doesn't mention wetlands in the definition section. It says waters. That coupled with the proposition that actually goes all the way back to Riverside Bayview, that wetlands in sort of ordinary parlance aren't considered in themselves waters. So if you accept those two propositions, then you can see how the test has to be continuous surface connection of water, because that's the only way you could say, oh, well, I can't quite tell, is this wetland or is this water? If the boundary is indistinct, then we'll say the whole thing can be regulated as a, quote, water. That is what's driving the test. It's not a scientific test. I'll certainly grant everyone that. It's not a scientific test. It's a test developed by judges trying to interpret a statute. And in that sense, it might seem a little clunky from a water quality perspective, but that doesn't, I think, make it any less valid as a legal test.
Thanks. JP?
No, I agree with Damian that the one thing this rule does represent is that the agencies have finally abandoned their efforts to define federal Clean Water Act jurisdiction based on ecological factors, because if they did, there would be no line. You know, that's the problem. That there is no way to, all waters are connected in some way and all contribute to either degradation if they're misused, or the enhancement of downstream waters. So that you have to come up with, you know, you have to talk about something that is it does not depend on the protection of navigable waters based on a regime that is based on their ecological protection, protecting them against all hazards that might attack them from an ecological standpoint. Because if you do that, there is no line, and the Clean Water Act certainly intends that there be a line. As far as the surface connection has to be an aquatic surface connection, I think is a perfectly reasonable point. The difficulty once again is implementation of how do you make that real? How do you achieve certainty? How do you achieve an analytical framework where I can tell, if I go out on my land, I can tell if I'm subject to Clean Water Act jurisdiction or not, or at least I can pay a reasonable amount of money to get an expert to tell me, which is what people do today. And a lot of very fine hydrologists and biologists and geologists that make a living doing that. But the test that we've got, I think, is going to be very difficult to administer.
So, JP, real quick, why not just make it what a ordinary person would look at and say, yeah, that's water? Why not just kind of use that in a rule, some type of language like that? Instead of an expectation that you have to have aerial photography or hydrologists, whatever, shouldn't we just look at what would I, if I look at that and I can't tell, an ordinary person can't tell where the water ends, land begins, then if you can't tell, then.
Yeah, well, Darren, the problem is you can't tell as to up to a certain point on Monday. And then it rains on Tuesday, and you can't tell. You can tell up to a different point, and then it's dry for a week, and then you can tell up to a different point. And so federal jurisdiction wanders about the landscape based on an infinitely varied hydrology, and year to year and month to month, that's not acceptable. We need certainty.
Thanks, Pat. Real quick.
Well, I have to respectfully disagree with JP on the statute's not ecological. That is exactly what a unanimous Supreme Court in Riverside Bayview said it was with regard to wetlands. So I'll just leave it at that. I just have to say, no, that's not true. It is an ecological statute, among other things. Let's go back to the origins of the act for a minute, okay? So when Congress coined the term waters of the United States, and I talked to the two authors of it many times, they're good friends of mine. Well, one's gone now. Tom Jorling's still around. I said, why the hell couldn't you define it? And he said, we tried. The best we could do is what we put into the conference report. And the conference report says very plainly, we intend the term to go to the limits of Congress's authority under the Commerce Clause. That's as good a definition of legal grounding as the Congress in 1972 was capable of. Could Congress today come up with a different definition? I'm sure it could. I'm sure I'd hate it. But the fact of the matter is it won't. And that's why we are where we are. And we shouldn't overlook that fact. This problem can be solved only one way, and that's by Congress. And maybe even then it won't be necessarily final, but it would be closer to final than where we are today. So I'll close with that. I think we need legislation on this, even though I probably would not like it.
Amen, brother.
Thanks, Ben. I have a couple of more questions. We'll just call this lightning round. So really right now, is a proposed rule consistent with Sackett? Just is it consistent? Not whether or not you like the rule from a policy matter or anything, but is it consistent with the Sackett opinion, Pat? What do you think?
No.
Okay.
It's not consistent in the sense of the wet season. interpretation. That's not based in Sackett, I don't think. And I sort of sense that maybe this panel maybe agrees with that, or at least in some to some extent. So that alone, there's a lot of problems with this rule. I've ticked off some of them. I'm not going to go back over that. We don't have time. But there are a lot of procedural problems with this rule that could bring it down. But that one for sure is not going to survive.
Thanks, Pat. JP.
Let me say this. I think it is the product of a very serious effort to understand and comply with the Supreme Court decision in Sackett. Now, the wet season language and the surface water language are glosses on Supreme Court language. The wet season concept it comes from the court saying, "Oh, well, the waters include relatively permanent bodies of water," and they go on to say, "So they didn't." And there's a difference between relatively permanent and permanent, or the court wouldn't have used the two words and thrown them together like that. So they have to ask themselves, what are they trying to talk about when they talk about relative permanency versus permanency? And this is what they came up with. Could they have done better? Let me tell you, I don't know that I could have done better. So I'm not particularly inclined to think that they could necessarily have done better, but it is certainly a serious effort to understand what the Supreme Court is trying to tell them and to follow it.
Thanks, JP. Damian.
In my view, I think the proposed rule is largely consistent with Sackett, but I would also add this. I'm not yet convinced that where I do believe the rule is not consistent with Sackett, that it's going to matter much on the ground. Meaning that although the wet season concept is opaque, its legal provenance is questionable, nevertheless, I'm not quite sure that on the ground there's going to be much of a difference, meaning that I, for example, I don't think that there are very many wetlands out there that don't have a continuous surface water connection, meaning 365 days a year, but do have a surface water connection that lasts at least a couple of months of the year. I think that those types of wetlands are probably few and far between. So my estimation is that even if there is a theoretical difference between what the rules finally says and what I think Sackett actually means, I think on the ground for the regulated public, it'll be largely the same. That, of course, is assuming everybody understands what the rule is, and that's JP's point, and I share his concerns, too, about clarity. But assuming clarity is not an issue, how it shakes out on the ground, I think, might not matter that much.
So to close it out, I want to give you guys a chance for last words. Just tell us, what is your kind of key takeaway for today's audience? And Pat, what's your kind of key takeaway on this proposed rule for the audience?
Well, if you thought that this rule resolves anything, you were mistaken. And the final chapter on Waters of the United States has yet to be written. I don't anticipate that will happen in this administration's term, and I don't know what to expect beyond that. I don't see Congress stepping in. So my message, unfortunately, is just learn to live with the uncertainty and perhaps even chaos that this rule will create.
Thanks, JP.
Well, I'm a little bit more optimistic than Pat is that the states will step up to this. The fundamental problem is that the states administer virtually every aspect of the Clean Air Act, and if you get a clean air permit, you're getting it from a state agency, and the federal agency, the EPA, has an oversight role to ensure that the state agencies are administering the program the way it should be administered. There is no, and they do that through a grant program, as Pat was describing his experience in Vermont. Much of his staff and much of my staff when I was the Secretary of Natural Resources, which in Virginia, much of our staff was at Virginia DEQ was funded through EPA grants. There is no grant program in place currently to support the Section 404 permitting program that governs the Corps' wetlands permitting jurisdiction for the dredging and filling in waters of the United States, including wetlands. It doesn't exist. And so the states, if they do undertake it, as Virginia has, as California, and we spoke of Colorado and New Mexico, they are doing that on their own dime. And they're doing it either through permit application fees of some kind, which is another tax on development that may not be popular, or they're just doing it through the general fund revenues that they take from their state taxpayers. And so I think that is a weakness in the overall federal scheme of environmental protection. I mentioned the air, but the other aspect of it is a point source permitting of point source discharges through the what's called the NPDES, the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System, is also supported by EPA grants. That's that program, the for point sources, like from factories and that sort of thing, is an EPA program. And those permits are state permits given by state agencies and supported by and funded by a federal grant in which the EPA performs an oversight role. There is no comparable program or provision for wetlands. And I think, as I say, I think that is a weakness in our federal system for protecting wetlands.
Thanks, JP. And Damon?
I think the takeaway that I would suggest is that I think this rule is getting closer to Sackett than the prior administration's rule. I also think that WOTUS rulemakings are not as important as they used to because of the abrogation of Chevron deference and other factors. And so I think, yes, I agree with Pat, the issue is going to be resolved in litigation, but I think it's going to be more a question of as applied as opposed to pre-enforcement rulemaking challenges.
Well, thank you, JP, Damien, and Pat. That was really informative. And thank you all for participating today. And I want to thank the Federal Society for putting this together. And Matthew, I'll turn it over to you.
Great. Thank you. Well, on behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank you all for joining us, and especially thank our speakers and Darren for this great conversation. And of course, lending your expertise and your time to us. So we greatly appreciate it. We also welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about upcoming virtual events. With that, thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.